This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal here with my co-host, the ever genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Really appreciate everybody taking time today to join us for Midrats. As a reminder for those that are joining us live, if you wanted to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find our chat room. That's a good place to roll in with the usual suspects. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the show, that's a great place to do it. That's also a great place if there are some questions that you would like directed to our guests that you want to make sure that we cover in the course of the next hour. Please put it in there. We'll be monitoring during the course of the show. And we are do our best to fold that in as we move forward. Also, if you find that you need to run off halfway through the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, or if you wanted to catch some of our previous episodes, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can take the shortcut and just subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes and listen at your leisure. But let's go ahead and get on with the show. We hear it a lot. People are our most important asset. But many times when you're reading the trade journals and the various things that you hear in the newspaper, people want to talk about programs. They want to talk about things displacing water, making shadows on the deck, or that have those contracts that have a whole bunch of zeros and commas attached to them. And we can occasionally get a disconnect what the people that have to run it, maintain it, and bring those national assets to the front. And those are our people. And we're going to talk today about both some present ideas and some directions on the future on personnel policy, not just on a maritime focus, but we're going to take a much broader brush, reaching with that great joint brush that we have. And our guest for the full hour to discuss this and perhaps a few other things is going to be Brad R. Carson. He is the Acting Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. He was appointed by President Obama to serve as the Acting Undersecretary on April 2nd of this year. That makes him the 31st Undersecretary of the United States Army and Chief Management Officer of the Army. That's his second job, of course. He's also previously served as the General Counsel for the Department of the Army, Special Assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and a really interesting background that we're going to tap into as well. He was a member of the U.S. Congress representing the 2nd Congressional District of Oklahoma last decade. He's also taught in academia and has been in a lawyer in private practice. He has also worn the uniform in his nation's service, including a deployment in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom in 08 and 09 as a United States Navy intelligence officer. He holds a bachelor's degree from Baylor University, Phi Beta Kappa. He also received a bachelor's and a master's degree in politics, philosophy, and economics from the University of Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. He also holds a JD from the University of Oklahoma. Secretary Carson, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having me on. I'm a great fan of the show and an honor to be a part of it today.
Yes, sir, Mr. Secretary, really appreciate it. And for our listeners, I thought it's an opportunity, like we do many times on the show, to let people know the seat you're occupying and the responsibilities you have right now. It's a pretty long title, to say the least. But if you could just outline for us a bit what the as Acting Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, what is your charter? And since you've been in the job, in addition to your Army responsibilities for the last 4 months, what are some of those bold-faced items that you've had to look at so far?
Well, I'm in charge of all the personnel issues facing the Department of Defense. Of course, each service has a personnel shop as well, where they handle matters that would fall underneath their Title 10 responsibilities. But I have supervision of those and am often quite involved in the shaping and approval of those policies. So everything from critical skills retention bonuses for pilots or nuclear officers to questions about transgender service, women in combat, other pay scale matters, all fall underneath the personnel side of the house. I also cover readiness for the department. And readiness is one of those terms that's not well understood outside of the department, and sometimes isn't that well understood even within it. But there we try to measure whether our troops are sustainable and ready for combat. And each of the services has slightly different approaches to answering that question. They have different metrics that they use in evaluating whether they are capable of fighting the nation's war plans. And we try to tell the Secretary of Defense, when he's making decisions about the deployment of troops across the globe, how this could affect the overall readiness of the force. That's another way of saying whether, you know, sending troops to a particular location could mean that a particular war plan or particular other effort might suffer, or whether the services might find themselves under great strain as a result of it. So it's an important responsibility that I'm honored to hold. When Secretary Carter asked me to do this about 100 days ago, I knew that he had many ideas about reforms in this area. I've been really fortunate in the 4 months I have been here to be involved in what I think are some of the most important matters that confront the Department of Defense right now.
As you took this job on, I think one of the important things is to kind of look backwards at the current system we have, because obviously part of your function is to reform what exists. What do we have now? I mean, I've heard it described as a 19th century industrial system. What do we have now, and what, in your view, are the big changes you would foresee? And we're going to broad brush this right now and get into detail later, but where do you see us going with the with what you'd like to see?
Well, you're right. The system is, in my mind, inadequate to the future needs. It has served us well in many ways over the last 70 years. On the military personnel side, the system is about 70 years old. On the civilian side, which is of equal concern to the Secretary and to me, it's really about 130 years old. And so to even call it an industrial age system is perhaps to flatter it a little bit. But when Secretary Carter just took office, one of his first official duties was to go to Abingdon, Pennsylvania, his old high school, and talk about what has become known as force of the future. And he talked about both the military and civilian personnel systems. And really his attempt in that talk was to inspire the young people with the same love of public service that he himself has carried throughout his career, leading him to a number of distinguished appointments in the Department of Defense, a great career at Harvard University, where he was a faculty member both in physics and in the government school, and try to tell people that, you know, he's concerned that, and maybe it's an intuition more than one based on evidence at that time at least, that with the fading of the 9/11 receding into memory, a time when football players, right, pro football players would quit their teams to go join the Ranger Regiment, that perhaps the public spiritedness that had come from those tragic events might be fading a little bit. At the same time, he was aware of many anecdotes that junior officers were leaving. And when you go truly to today's top graduate schools, Harvard, Chicago, Wharton, schools like that, they're populated by veterans of the armed services. At the same time, our civilian workforce is getting older. Younger people have a hard time kind of penetrating the opaque bureaucracy that surrounds hiring processes. And to be frank, not that many young people you talk to say that, yes, serving at the Department of Defense as a civilian is something that I aspire to do over the course of my life, or even at the start or in the middle of my career. So that was kind of his hunch, and he talked about it there at Abingdon. And this Force of the Future now has become one of the big events in the department over the last 4 months, where we are going out and trying to look at the military system, the civilian system, and see what can we do? Where has it succeeded in the past? Where are possible problems going to arise in the future? I think in both cases, we're going to see that there are many problems looming before us. On the military side, for example, there is an increasing premium on having technically skilled people with high cognitive ability, and we have to have lots of them. And these aren't simply for kind of esoteric disciplines like cyber or signal. But we're talking, you have to have your very smartest people out there in the infantry, where they are confronted with a lot of data, a lot of changing circumstances, a non-contiguous battlefield in which more and more responsibility is being devolved onto junior leaders. You know, 30 years ago, much less 300 years ago, a company commander did not have kind of organic, you know, indirect fire support, didn't have surveillance support organically. He was closely tethered to his battalion or his brigade when he needed some kind of support. Now we send company commanders out to far-flung locations, hundreds of miles from higher headquarters. When they're confronted with an enemy, they have to make decisions on the spot about when and how to fight. They have to be able to call in the full weight of combined arms to protect themselves. This is an unprecedented leadership task for young officers. And so there's this incredible demand for more highly skilled people than ever before. And I think it's going to be a challenge for us to meet that demand. Already the Army is having trouble meeting its recruiting goals, and the Army is often a leading indicator of recruiting problems. There is, I think, a problem of long-term retention of people in some of these key disciplines. And maybe most fundamentally, there's kind of a one-size-fits-all mentality in the military personnel system, especially, where there's a golden path for success in each of the services. You need to hit key command spots, key development positions. If you don't do those, if you want to take time out for perhaps advanced civil schooling, or maybe you know, you have a sick family member you must take care of, or you want to go gain expertise out in the private sector in some way that you could bring back to the military, you fall off that golden path. And as a result, your career prospects are dimmed. In this diverse world where the requirements upon senior leaders, junior leaders are ever expanding, right, we have to have a more varied career system if we're going to be successful. So Force the Future is about kind of thinking how we can revitalize a military personnel system that has, again, done well in the past, but needs to do better still in the future.
In one of your earlier answers, you mentioned something that you know, propped into my mind a conversation I had with a few JOs earlier this year. Is in my career, you know, before I left active duty back in 2009, and more than predate that, is when there was a squeeze for a certain skill set, whether it's a designator, an NACC, or something like that. One of the first tools that we would reach for is the bonus tool. If you are this person with this kind of skill set at this year point, then you will get X amount of dollars. If not, you'll get Y number of dollars, whether people are asking for it or not. Whereas especially the junior personnel that I speak of, and these are usually young men and women between 25 and 35, the bonus and the money is not the issue that comes up with them. There are other issues that, from a retention point of view, are weighing on their minds more. There are a few that focused on money, but I think an argument could be made if that's your primary concern, that you probably picked the wrong line of work to begin with. But what are some of those personnel issues that you think inside the lifelines of DOD you have a relative bit of control over? But what are some of those things that you would need to find partners and centers of understanding up at the Hill in the House and the Senate to help give y'all the ability to perhaps do a few things with personnel policy that you don't have full control over as things stand right now?
Well, you're exactly right that we're going to need some legislative help here, because DOPMA, D-O-P-M-A, stands for the Defense Officers Personnel Management Act, passed in 1980, really with roots to 1947 across all the services. And in the services that I know you two care so much about, the Navy, it goes back far beyond that to the turn of the century when they had plucking boards and things such as that. And so we're going to need legislative change to DOPMA, which includes a lot of kind of the internal directives and instructions that we've put forward here at the Defense Department in interpreting it. So right now, for example, if someone wants to stay as a major doing whatever work they are, perhaps they're a pilot, perhaps they're a cyber warrior, whatever it is, they cannot do that in perpetuity, simply because if they're passed over twice for promotion, when that fixed promotion point comes, right, they're required to separate from the service. You can imagine a world, and this is one of the recommendations we're probably going to make in Force of the Future, to have a technical track, not unlike warrants in some of the services, in which people could stay doing the same job for a longer period of time and not be forced into this up-or-out system. The up-or-out system has many merits. We don't want it to be like the Army was before World War II, where George Marshall and Dwight Eisenhower, Curtis LeMay, were captains or majors for almost two decades at a time. You had to wait for someone to die before you could assume the spot. But there is a way to say, look, you know, we can have separation boards, we can have officers working on contracts. There's a way to still make sure we have control where people don't just homestead in a job, but at the same time allowing people who perhaps don't want to be a general officer someday to have a long and distinguished career in the services. And we need to do allow people more flexibility in their lives. Because I think you're right that bonuses are not always the best tool we have to encourage people to stay in the military. We need to pay a competitive salary. We need people to be able to make ends meet. But you don't join the military for money. You join for the mission, the important mission of it. And lots of times, you know, we send money out when people want something different. For example, the Army has been much more successful in the last few years are getting away from monetary bonuses and instead asking people to sign up for a longer period of time, and you can choose your branch and have preference in branching decisions, or you have preference in your follow-on duty stations. You have preference in advanced civil schooling opportunities. These are things that make people sign up for three or four more years at a time. I would like to see that expanded. People can stay in one location longer. I can't tell you the number of officers I speak to, enlisted personnel too, who say, you know, my spouse is finishing up her degree. She's perhaps in her medical residency, or she's a lawyer, because high-speed people today marry other high-speed people. And we need to stay in the Washington, D.C. area, or the Denton, Texas area, or the Minot, North Dakota area, for a longer period of time than kind of the rapid churn of assignments would otherwise permit. And I'll sign up for a longer hitch in the military if I do that. So we need to bring those into our retention decisions. We need to relax the up-or-out promotion system while still retaining selectivity over who can stay. We need to, I think, expand careers, make them longer. You know, it doesn't make sense to me that in many, maybe most career fields in the military, you get better every day you do the job. So you think, we'll take an area that I used to work in here in the department, the legal community. Lawyers are better at 45, 55, even 65 than they are at 25 or 35. But we force you out of the military at 55 if you're in the JAG Corps, if you're 30 years of service. And all I could, if you're a colonel, you can retire in your early 40s at a time when you're just reaching the peak of your career, peak of your powers. This doesn't make much sense. We're losing lots of good people who might like to stay longer. If we could give them alternative paths, if we could extend their careers, we could be a better military as a result of it. If we gave people more flexibility so that they could stay in locations longer, they could go get their civil schooling. Perhaps they want to get out altogether, go join the reserve component for a few years, work at Google and be a reservist, and then come back in later. That transition between the active component and reserve component today is a bear. I mean, you have to be a serious bureaucratic operator to be able to make it back and forth between the AC and the RC. We need to make that seamless for people. And if we do that, we'll be more effective. Today, legislation, also some, again, regulations here at DOD, but maybe even more powerfully, culture in the department makes those kind of reforms both important but very difficult to implement.
Yeah. I have some questions about it, obviously, like everybody else will, about how this works. But it seems to me that what you describe in some ways is even more of a stovepipe system than we already have, where we have intel guys, we have JAG people, we have engineering duty officers, we have aviators, so forth and so on. But we would lock we would have more of those. I mean, if we add cyber in there and some other groups, I could see that there are maybe the line community, the warfighters, is going to be a whole maybe younger area. But is that kind of where you see this going? Because I can't imagine some 55-year-old guy out there dragging an 80-pound rucksack around.
Well, they're probably not going to be dragging an 80-pound rucksack going over a mountain in Afghanistan. But that's a small part of what the military does today. You know, you take the infantry in the U.S. Army, which has 500,000 people today, a little more than 50,000 of them are infantry. So even though they establish the ethos and are kind of the, you know, paradigm of the Army, really only a little more than a tenth of the Army does that. The rest are enablers or support, do other kinds of things. So I don't want it to be stovepiped. I mean, the kind of reforms we're talking about, which allows people to do more diverse things, get schooling, take care of their family, stay in, I want to apply to the command track as well. You know, for example, the U.S. Army today has, in its colonel ranks, about 360 people with PhDs. There are 6 general officers who have PhDs. That's because to get that doctorate degree, right, they fell off the track, that they couldn't get that KD assignment in, they couldn't be the 3, the XO, right, these kinds of things, that by giving more time, more flexibility in these kind of rigidly managed timelines, will allow more people to do interesting things, and we'll have more people who are warrior scholars at the top, who come from the combat arms, yes, because the combat arms are really the feedstock to all the top leadership positions in the services. But maybe they took time off. Maybe they're going to be like a Nimitz, you know, who went and studied German shipbuilding in the interwar period for 2 or 3 years. Today, it'd be hard to make admiral if you had done something like that. That's the kind of place we need to be as a military personnel system, one with more flexibility that recognizes that, you know, a chief of staff of the Air Force or the Army who spent 2 years working at Google or Facebook on a fellowship would bring inestimable value to us in running their service someday. Right now, our service chiefs don't have that kind of background, not because they might not want to do it, but simply because the system does not permit you to rise to the highest ranks if you've chosen to do something like that.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, cultural issues, and there's an old cliche, you get what you select. And I think that works both ways. You have people who are on selection boards, and you're never going to find a perfect selection board system. I think we all know that. All human institutions have their quirks. But people tend to do 2 things. They select in their own image. That's one signal that goes into it. And also ambitious officers, like ambitious people in all careers, if they want to be at a certain place, they will look at the person that's there. And maybe their ambition is to be a commanding officer or an admiral, et cetera. But everybody tells them that's what they're supposed to think if they think that way. You have to do that? Okay, fine. What are those people done to get there? They had to do X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3. And I think you've touched on it. As part of the problem is instead of doing X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, somebody does PDQ, 4, 5, and 6. And they also see everybody else who has done that never makes it past whatever board they're shooting for. So they simply don't do it. Being that you, inside the system, certain system we have, only certain people are going to be promoted on average. You do have exceptions. But you do have a critical mass of a certain flavor of people. So, you know, what are some of the things that we can do to address that very inherently human institution of select boards, such that a young man or woman who's 25, 26, or 27, who might want to do one of these programs you're talking about, has some confidence that when it comes board time, that they're not going to be evaluated people pressing 0, 25, 50, 75, or 100, those that look at that strange and different and do the math, well, they didn't follow the rule of never be first and never be last at something, so we're going to press 50. I think that's a big challenge. Have y'all discussed how that particular barrier can be looked at or addressed, or perhaps changing the precepts of the board that haven't really changed that much at all in the future?
Well, that is an important point, and it is the most challenging aspect of these kind of reforms. The things I've talked about are actually supported widely throughout the Pentagon, much to the surprise of many. The Navy, for example, has been extraordinarily progressive on these matters, both on the uniform side and on civilian leadership. The Army's not far behind, the Air Force is there, the Marine Corps themselves are intrigued by these kind of ideas. But all of us recognize that the cultural changes are really important. We see this today in the Navy, for example. The Navy has established a career intermission program, a sabbatical, where you can take time off to take care of personal needs or family issues or whatever. The program is undersubscribed typically because most people think that, yes, it's available to us, but if I go use it, this will hurt my promotion chances later in the board. What was I doing for those couple of years, even though there's an additional service obligation on the back end of it? We see this with even some of our most high-speed programs in the department. A few years ago, you may remember, they started the AFPAC HANDS program, which was going to bring really the best and brightest to deal with some of the problems we were having in those two wars. And they had extraordinarily smart people involved. They were at the highest of levels. They recruited young people to become AFPAC HANDS. And now, of course, it's fallen a bit into disfavor. We're out of one of those conflicts. And many of the AFPAC HANDS personnel find that their promotion chances have been diminished. In fact, when the Army, in their kind of forcible separations over the last year or so, they've had to downsize, the AFPAC HANDS community is really taking a real beating in that. And so many there, right, see it like, you know, it was once seen as something we wanted to do to get ahead, and now it's actually holding us back. So these cultural issues are really important and difficult to get to. I guess I would say two things about it. One is, while culture is the most important part of military life, sometimes the rules and regulations we put in place can push culture to be in the right place and can save it from itself. And that's our hope here, is that by establishing new rules, new regulations, by talking about it a lot, we can spur internal cultural change where people are demanding more at the junior levels and senior officers are seeing ideas that might take root in their service. In the end, it's going to be about promotions, though. And the service secretaries, the Secretary of Defense, do get to sign off on all of those boards. And they need to have, in my mind, more visibility into who the boards are selecting, the characteristics of the people. They need to scrupulously write those precepts where the kind of people that we want and who we are encouraging to do diverse things, not just because it's a good thing to do, but it makes us a better fighting force, right, that they're rewarded for that over time. And it's not a simply kind of homogeneous population in the general officer, flag officer ranks, or who get promoted to the highest levels of the services, even below the flag level. And they can approve those kind of things. They appoint the service chiefs, the Secretary of Defense does. And these are the kind of things, right, that engaged civilian leadership, working with right-minded service chiefs and other service leaders, can put in place. There is no solution to it other than that. But I think greater visibility into kind of who's being selected, the diversity of choices, the backgrounds, precepts that are carefully written can get to this issue. And we'll try to monitor it over time. But the cultural changes are really hard. And perhaps the first step is being taken, which is we don't underestimate the power of culture.
As we're discussing this, there seem to be I'm going to go back to this, two separate tracks. One is the technical expertise you need to do your job. And I think that's, you know, we talk about STEM and other programs, but there's also the people who have the and should acquire the knowledge, the historical knowledge of how things were, you know, to go back to the, what Mahan said, you have to study Napoleon or those old the old wars to understand the new wars to a certain extent. In this structure that you envision, is there a place for both those groups where we have people who are technically proficient and people who have the historical background to be human terrain experts and stuff like that?
Absolutely. I mean, I want to see a world where those master's degrees, which need to come as much from civilian institutions as they do from the war colleges, which has been the trend really in the last 20 years, more officers have master's degrees than ever before, but they're mostly from the staff colleges, but they're going out to civilian institutions and not simply studying engineering or a technical discipline, although those are extraordinarily important. I'd like to see people getting master's and PhDs in anthropology, in military history, a whole field that has fallen into disfavor around the country, it seems like. But there are still vibrant programs at Ohio State and other places like that, that we're getting PhDs in English literature, in broader historical matters. Because I think that is something when you're a senior leader in the military, you need to understand. You have to have the command of 3,000 years at your fingertips or you will fail. And so, yes, it's not simply about technical disciplines. It's about saying we need people of extraordinary cognitive ability who understand the way people are and the world works and has always been. And we need to recruit those people in, and we need to retain them over time, and we need to develop them, too, and then make sure they're promoted up to be the people who make decisions in the services. So I think it's really important. You know, in my mind, I could see a chief of staff in any of the services in 20 years who has a PhD from Princeton in English literature, you know, and studied Shakespeare while he was there, and then came back in and, you know, led a fighter squadrons and wings or BCTs, you know, or commanded the fleet at some point. I mean, this is the kind of person that we're going to need in the future. Said it's not about a kind of monomaniacal pursuit of excellence in one field. You need to be someone who is very broad and also deep. They're not at the expense of one another anymore. They're complements, not substitutes. And we need to find ways to groom those kinds of people, or we risk not being able to meet the future challenges.
Well, yeah, I can't say anything more than amen to that. I think the way you describe that, and it's something that we've talked about on the show here with prior guests before, I think your perspective on that is just plain spot on how critical that broad, deep knowledge and understanding beyond the technical field, especially for our senior leaders, and not only for the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that they advise, but also those who wear coat and ties on the civilian side that they work for, to be able to have that knowledge base and perspective to be able to provide such good advice. Before I jump down that rabbit hole, because that is one of my favorite rabbit holes, I wanted to tap into something that, as I mentioned in the opening, that I find just really an extra underline to your background of the position that you have right now. Back when you and I were still trying to figure out our sophomore year in college, there was the overall framework was put in place that we still live under. And, you know, back in the mid 80s, there was the great Red Banner fleet. We didn't know it at the time, but the Soviet Union was, you know, a little bit past its peak, but was still big. The geopolitical world was huge. There were still no such thing as a 3.5-inch floppy disk, much less anything else in that regard. And a fast communication was 9.6 baud. But Goldwater Nichols was created. And there's been discussions, very smart people, very connected people, that we need to really take a fresh look and to update, replace, or otherwise find a new structure to build and define how we work our national defense infrastructure that's in tune with the 21st century and not the mid-1980s. But to do that, you have to have the right people in place in the House and in the Senate and in the DOD. At what stage, you know, stage zero is the beginning and stage five is when you have a president sign the bottom line. In that discussion of looking for something to replace or improve or otherwise modernize the Goldwater Nichols process and how our Joint Chiefs work, where are we in that process? And have we reached the point of momentum, or is it still something that's sitting on the shelf that people are looking at but aren't ready to grab hold of yet?
I think on Capitol Hill, they're in about phase two. John McCain, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has expressed his interest in Goldwater Nichols reform, and rightfully so, it seems to me. The statute is now 27 years old, and the world has changed a lot. and we have some history to see how it works. I think it is going to be interesting to see kind of how it plays out over the next few years, simply because many of the potential problems that were discussed at the time that Goldwater-Nichols was passed have been alleviated in some extent by the fact we've had a lot of resources over time, the real trade-offs between the services, service rivalries. You know, when there's a lot of money, those things aren't as acute as they're going to be in the next few years, where there are real trade-offs between the capacity of the U.S. Army and Marine Corps, for example, and the needs for greater capability in the Navy and the Air Force. So not everybody's going to be getting along in those kind of decisions. And it's going to put, I think, a lot of stress on kind of how things have been done here. And so that history will be informing, I think, inform this process. In terms of DOD, I still say we're at phase zero or phase one. Again, people are watching it. I think people are generally satisfied with how most of Goldwater-Nichols has come about. They are interested in learning, and there's been quite a bit of academic work sponsored by the services about how jointness has really played out over the last 15 years of conflict. But I think people have seen good things that came from Goldwater-Nichols. In terms of the personnel side where I work, this is one of the things we are actually looking at quite closely. And then I do think that some of the joint requirements have become too burdensome. They are just part of that treadmill you're on, that, hey, I've got to get my 3 years joint qualification in, and, you know, that's got to fit in between my KD spot and my command spot and my staff college work and all of these kinds of things. If I have to cool my heels at any time, you know, waiting for one of these jobs to open up, right, that's even more time taken out off the treadmill. And so it's hard to get some of your joint requirements in, and they prohibit you from doing other work that might be interesting. Again, advanced civil schooling, corporate fellowships, more time on the Army staff or one of the service staffs, those kinds of things. And so at least for some people in the service, I'd like to see those myself, some of those requirements relaxed, because I think jointness is so imbued in us now that, you know, a certain tour isn't necessary to get it, and maybe rethink how we do those requirements. So it's still in a much more, the discussion of Goldwater-Nichols, still in more kind of the cocktail banter phase here at the Department of Defense, at least that I have seen, than it is on Capitol Hill, where I think people are thinking very seriously about it during the workday.
As you pursue improving the system, I know that you've got a report to the Secretary of Defense. I guess it's a report, I don't know quite what to call it, on these suggestions that you would be making as to how the, I mean, in your letter that I've seen to him, a memo to him, you described this as a revolutionary process. Can you kind of discuss in broad outline what is going to be in your report to the Secretary of Defense about suggestions of how to improve the system?
Absolutely. We have already written up about 80 different reform proposals which are divided into 30 groups and sent them out to the services for their coordination and their discussion, as well as the joint staff. I'm in the process, as we speak, of writing the longer report that discusses the need for personnel reform. And the need for, as I have said prominently, both to the Secretary of Defense and in the media, the need for us to really revolutionize the way we think about people here in the building. You go out to the private sector, for example, and there has been nothing short of a revolution in human resources. It used to be that the private sector, say 70 years ago, looked to the military for how to structure its management of people. You know, the railroads, kind of the first corporate organizations in this country, looked to the Prussian military for how to kind of how to organize themselves. The military spent a lot of time thinking about it, about command and control, about leadership, and businesses would look to the military for best practices. Our civilian personnel system was put in place a long time ago, really on those models. At that time, the military and civilian personnel systems were not that dissimilar and didn't need to be that dissimilar. In the last 20 years, enabled by information technology, the civilian world has diverged sharply from where the military is and where our own civilian personnel system remains in the Department of Defense and really across the federal government. So you go out to, and it's not simply the big Silicon Valley companies. We're talking about any leading company today, General Electric, Procter & Gamble, the car companies, but yes, the ones that are in information technology too. And they're doing now mass customization of careers, if you will, where they are using these tools to say, we're going to find the talents that you have, not simply your cognitive ability, although that might be part of it, but some of your non-cognitive traits as well. And we're going to find the right job for you. We're going to be able to match up your aspirations with the organization's needs. We're going to be able to get you the right development over time. We're going to use big data, all this stuff we collect, and make predictions about your retention, about what your desires are going to be, so we can anticipate and meet them. This is what's happened in the private sector. In the public sector, we haven't done that. In the military, we have far from done that. And so, again, it's kind of a one-size-fits-all system. If you go to most of the service personnel commands, they use Excel spreadsheets to kind of manage the people. If you ask the services, hey, who's the best performers you have? Who are the very best people? The human resources folks can usually tell you they're very top folks, and they use proxies to determine that. If you have perfect officer evaluation reports or fitness reports, and you had a job as aide-de-camp to the general, this floats you to the top of the pile. But they don't know the individual talents of every person in that stack, and they don't really know the depth of quality they have as well. And so there is a degree you're just another cog in the machine, and they assign you to Fort Polk or Korea or the National Capital Region, basically dependent upon what's easiest for them. The revolution is saying we can do that same kind of individual tailoring of careers in the military and in the DoD civilian sector without compromising the readiness of our force. So we're leaving a lot of talent on the cutting room floor by a system that 75 years ago was state of the art, worked well for us for many decades, but today has been superseded by developments elsewhere that we should adopt ourselves and get ahead of. And so yes, that means in my mind relaxing, if not repealing, up or out. It's about having more technical tracks. It's about insisting upon advanced civil schooling. It's about having IT systems across the board that can track people. It's about having IT-enabled job matching. You know, for example, I have an Army colonel who works for me who discussed his time at Fort Benning many years ago now, where there was a bulletin board where people would trade assignments out, and they would put note cards up saying, I'm slated to go to Korea. I'll give you my Jeep plus $10,000 to go to Fort Riley, Kansas, where my family is. And there was a robust black market of trading assignments. I think IT today can do that in spades, and we should use it to be able to improve the efficiency of job matching, which will make people happier. It'll lead to retention. It will lead to decreased training dollars, while also making us more efficient. People will want to be at the duty station they're assigned. That's what the revolution is. It's about saying, hey, the private sector is doing amazing things. We should do the same.
And I think that would also help address one of the critiques that I hear. And people don't like a feeling of powerlessness, that they're just a cork floating around on a broad ocean being blown this way or the other way. They could have a little motor where they could have, though maybe not full control, at least steer in a certain direction. You know, when you're looking at things you can do to type, kind of keep some of your bright, hard-charging personalities, it may not be the whole answer, but that's definitely, you know, part of the answer. I wanted to back up a bit on kind of a big pixel question, because you have a Navy background, but you also have, you know, responsibilities you've taken care of with your Army position, but now you're up as the DoD level, deep purple, so to speak. And it seems, at least in 2015, we're at a situation where the United States Navy, what used to be 6-month deployments, we now have 8 to 9 month deployments, or the new normal. And that demand signal is such that when we do gap a carrier, it becomes significant news. But the Army continues to reset while also undergoing not insignificant force reductions. And there's been some discussions about looking at the polite gentleman's agreement of the budget, one-third, 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 and really looking at what are the forces we need to respond to what our national requirements are. Discussions in forum, I don't know if you had a chance to read Ian Bremmer's latest book on three choices, which I think is a great discussion point, because I think he does good justice to three broad concepts of what America from a national security point of view should look at long term. But each one of those equations would, if you were going to make notes on a legal pad to the side, wouldn't be supported by one-third, one-third budgeting. How does that look inside of DOD? And those who do wear a DOD and not a service hat, so to speak, how does one work that umpire, so to speak, from the three different stories that you get from the major services?
Well, let me just say, if we're Deep Purple, I want to be the Richie Blackmore of this operation.
Excellent.
As we go out and play Smoke on the Water. That's a really hard question. I mean, I think it's a bit of a myth that there's a gentleman's agreement that the budgets will be equally divided among the services. If you look over time, that's really not been the case, especially if you look at some of the overseas contingency operation dollars that flow. For a long time, the Air Force got a lion's share of the money back when strategic bombing was seen as the key to national security. In the course of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Army seemed to get a disproportionate share. The Navy buildup in the 80s led to a different distribution still. So I don't know that it's always the case that we have this gentleman's agreement that we kind of ignore national security needs and divide the money up evenly. But I think it does raise the question which you offer me, and I haven't had the chance to read Bremmer's book, although I look forward to doing so, about how you divide a more or less static defense budget when there are enormous requirements going forward that one could offer pretty compelling justifications for. The Army might say, for example, hey, Russia has reemerged. We have to guarantee European security, and we don't have enough people today, as we are slated to go to 450,000, perhaps lower than that, if sequestration works its kind of insidious hold on the building. 420,000. We don't have enough people. And if Russia is our biggest threat, which several of the service chiefs and the new chairman have said in his testimony to Congress, we need a bigger army, maybe a bigger Marine Corps too. If, on the other hand, you think of China as being kind of the pacing threat, well, hey, the long-range strike bomber, the Ohio-class submarine replacement, the F-35, the KC-46, these are programs that are extravagantly expensive, but quite possibly essential to the future as well. So how do you trade these kinds of things off? These are debates we have every day at the department, and they really are ones decided by the secretary about how you, what is the real threat? What do we prepare for? Is it the most likely versus the most dangerous? Do we trade capacity for capability? I think we're still wrestling with many of those questions. That's one of the things Ash Carter has really said about adding rigor to, is how you think of those kind of questions, because people do realize that not everyone should get the same amount, but the amounts you get should be determined by how you see the world is developing and what your concept of operations to deal with those new threats might be.
Well, speaking of different kinds of threats and challenges for personnel, the new cyber warfare commands that are springing up, and the need to bring in people with the technical expertise to be effective in that type of work. I mean, they command very high salaries outside of either the military or, I would think, the government service. As we spring up these new commands, which are vital and a whole new form of warfare, what direction do you see us taking to attract the right type of people to do that particular mission area?
Well, the right kind of people are really the key. Just to go back to what I was saying a moment ago about these hugely expensive programs, what we are finding is In this day and age, technological superiority is harder and harder to maintain. While we don't sell or give away, people steal from us, often through cyber means. You, I'm sure, have tracked the debate about an offset strategy here, a third offset strategy that we need to deal with the world. In my mind, talent, good people, is really the third offset strategy. It is our only enduring advantage that other countries cannot replicate or steal from us. Cyber is a great area of that. I think we are struggling right now to fill our cyber billets, but to get enough people in and have people trained up and then keep them. If you go, for example, to Carnegie Mellon and graduate with a BS degree in computer science, the top job last year for Carnegie Mellon paid that 22-year-old $185,000. The average salary coming out of the program was $90,000. So come join the services or even become a civilian cyber warrior for Department of Defense. And we might start you, if you're a civilian, at a GS 7 or 8 level. You would have nowhere near the kind of salary that you could get in the private sector. We'll never be able to match that. That's for sure. People come to us for a mission. You can do incredible stuff, high-end hacking, wearing your white hat that you can't do anywhere else in the world. But we do have to pay people competitively. And one of the Force of the Future reforms is about giving people greater rewards when they're highly competent. Bonuses have done that in the past. I'd be for raising even base pays in hard-to-fill MOSs and designators. I think that's really important for us to do that. We have to pay people a little bit more. We have to give them more training. We have to erode that kind of upper route system. Right now, we have people at Army Cyber Command, for example, who, right, to keep promoting up, they've got to go, you know, leave the Cyber Command and go back out into the field to do something really irrelevant to their work in cyber. This is not a system that's conducive for us getting the right talent in to do this important mission. So these are only going to grow over time. The demands are extraordinary. The private sector is intensely competing with us. And that's really why we have to revamp our personnel systems. We're not going to be able to compete in cyber. But the important thing for me, too, is cyber, more and more of our branches, more and more of our work is like cyber. It's highly cognitive in nature, requires extraordinary technical skill. It's not about humping rucksacks over the mountains. We do a lot of that. And you got to be really smart to be a good infantryman. But more and more, it's about people who said are super skilled and super trained and have many opportunities outside of the military or federal civilian service to go make a lot of money and also do very interesting work.
Secretary Carson, I just looked at the clock. This has been a real quick hour. Before we went, I wanted to reach in to the back of the folder here, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to help inform something, inform the listeners on something that unfortunately many people aren't aware of. Last decade, you know, Afghanistan was my theater for those that define it by where you deploy, and Iraq was yours. And back when he was Secretary of Defense, SecDef Hagel appointed you to lead a working group that looked on veterans of Operation Iraqi Freedom who were injured by exposure to chemical weapons in theater. And if you could just take a minute for the listeners and describe what you did in that group, what you learned about how this was ignored for so long, and what steps have we taken since then to better serve those veterans of Operation Iraqi Freedom who were injured by chemical weapons during their deployment.
Well, that work has been among the most meaningful that I have done at the Department of Defense. The Army had the biggest problem, and so Secretary Hagel did appoint me to lead the efforts to solve it. And what we'd seen was a number of service members from really all of the services asserted that they had been exposed to chemical weapons during their time in Iraq. Sometimes it was because a chemical weapon of some kind, ammonia, had been attached to an IED in an attempt to augment its effect. More often, they were EOD technicians or people who were working with them who would come across a cache, maybe an active cache, maybe one going back before the first Gulf War in Providence. And as they were demilling it, a shell would break open, and it turned out to be a chemical round. and they would be exposed to sarin or mustard or other dangerous chemicals. The challenge we found was that all of that kind of work was classified at the time. We didn't want the enemy to become aware of TTPs or what we were finding or what was even out there that might be of concern to us that they could find in some other cache. And so it was sent up to places that I ended up working for myself in Iraq, Task Force Troy, and their databases collecting all of the SIGACs and all of the IED reports from the EOD units. And they were classified. Sometimes the Iraq study group and others would fly in if it was a particularly bad one, like there was a sarin problem in northern Iraq at one point. They would fly in to investigate the big receptacles that had the precursors in them. And right, it was a different chain of command. It was classified. And so people would sometimes not get back to the service members at all and tell them what had happened to them. Many times the symptoms of this kind of chemical exposure are similar to the flu or similar to heat exhaustion. So you'd show up at the infirmary there, the field hospital, and people they'd been told about possible chemical exposure that the doctors had, but you know, they saw you with something that seemed explained by a more common malady. And so they have long had suspicions that they were exposed to something but didn't know much about it. And so what I did in that process was identify all of those people. Some of them were raised by the terrific work Chris Chivers did in the New York Times. Some of those names were part of his stories. And we reached out to all of them saying, come up to Walter Reed. We'll give you a full medical evaluation, and we'll see whether you have long-term health effects. We'll tell you what you can be looking for. If you haven't had effects yet, but maybe will over time, we'll make sure the Veterans Administration is treating you fairly in this. And maybe most importantly of all, or equally important to that, is the Army, and I apologized on behalf of the Army for the fact that we hadn't got this information out to them earlier, that we should have told people more quickly and declassified some of the information to say, here's what you were exposed to, and here's what you need to be wary of for your health. So, important project, one that's still ongoing, and will no doubt be ongoing for decades as these service members live their lives. But it's an example, in my mind, of Secretary Hagel, who I admire immensely, pushing the department to do the right thing, which is be full and open in its communication, and then say, look, you know, we can't make up for the past, but we can get it right going forward, and we'll come and try to give you the health care you deserve and get you into the VA system that can offer still more care.
Well, that's terrific. I was kind of off center here, but as you've moved up through the food chain, if you will, to your current position, have there been things that surprised you in the complexity of the issues you were facing, or areas of resistance you didn't expect as you float some of these proposals out?
You know, I've been pleased by the fact that most people acknowledge the importance of personnel reforms that I'm working on today, for example. There are no real defenders of the current system. Those people who might be skeptical of my approach are really ones who say, yes, we wouldn't do the system we have today again, but moving away from it is really hard. There are a lot of expectations, lives, processes that have been baked into the current system, so it's hard to move away from that, which I take that as a very serious criticism, and the implementation of these kind of reforms is something I'm trying to spend a lot of time thinking through. But for me, having now done three jobs in the Pentagon over the last 3 years, things I'm amazed by that perhaps aren't well known to the broader American public is how extraordinarily hardworking and how amazingly smart and committed the people I work with really are. You know, in the Army, I saw 3-star generals. They work from 5 in the morning till 10 at night. They work 6-7 days a week. They were passionate about what they did. They would maybe not always agree with something I wanted to do, but they were more than worthy adversaries on those few occasions we did disagree, and they were usually brilliant in kind of their thinking. And I've seen this really across the building, that I leave here amazingly impressed by the people who lead our military and their willingness to think through what we need to do to ensure continued success, and their deep and abiding concern for the fate of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who serve under them. These are men, women who love the people around them and who serve for them. And that is an incredible thing to see. It's a very inspiring thing to see. I never take that for granted.
And our guest for the hour has been Acting Undersecretary for Defense for Personnel and Readiness, Secretary Brad Carson. Secretary Carson, this has just been a great hour. I really appreciate you coming on and to discuss these issues with our listeners today.
Thank you both for having me on, and keep up the good work. I look forward to listening to future podcasts.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And thank you for everybody who's joined us for another edition of MidRats. And if you want to, you can join us next week when our guest will be Naval War College Professor and Course Director for Security Strategy and Forces, Tom Nichols. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. The sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly. Farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.